You're listening to Mammal Watching with Charles Foley and John Hall. You can find other episodes at mammalwatching.com/podcast.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the podcast. This is Charles Foley talking to you from New York City.
And this is John Hall, also from New York City. Now, I know what you might be thinking. For those who listened to the last episode, Charles was here in New York with me. No, he hasn't moved in. This is the same afternoon. Spoiler alert, we're doing this in advance because we'll both be traveling over the next weeks. And Charles, you're actually off to Spain this evening. So have you got any plans to look for mammals there?
Yes, I do indeed. One of the things that I try to do whenever I get to Spain is take a few days off and go to Andújar, which is where, of course, the Spanish lynx have their stronghold. And it's not too far from where I'll be staying, so I can typically get there within a few hours. And I don't know if many of our listeners have been to Andújar, but it really is an amazing place. And the Spanish lynx was the rarest carnivore on the planet. Its numbers dropped to less than 100 at one point, mostly because its main prey base, which was the rabbit, had been affected so badly by various diseases, myxomatosis and another disease. I tried to go over there and see if I can find the lynx. And to be honest, they're not that difficult to see because they're the top predator. They're not really afraid of anything. And so it's not that hard to see them, although in the summer it's more difficult. But I still remember the first time I went there, our oldest daughter, she was quite young, and it was the first time we had left her alone. We left her with my parents. And my wife, Laura, and I were on slightly different wavelengths as to how long we were going to spend away. She thought 2 nights maximum, and I thought, well, as long as it takes to actually see the lynx. But anyway, she won. And so we spent 2 days over there, and it was really intense, just all afternoon looking for these things, all getting late at night, early in the mornings. And we spent hours and hours and hours in the field just searching and scanning and nothing. And then we said, okay, we have to leave by 9 o'clock in the morning. So we got up at really early in the morning, went and positioned ourselves overlooking a valley. And 7 o'clock came along, nothing. 8 o'clock came along, nothing. 8:30, nothing. And then at 8:45, I see a female lynx walking up a slope. And I'm ecstatic. And I start shouting out, saying, I see one, I see one. And there are a few other people over there. They all came out and had a look. And the animal just meandered up the slope. And then two young lynx cubs came out and joined her.
Oh, fantastic.
And it was just an amazing sighting. And that was it. Said, okay, marvelous, fantastic. One of the best days of my life in the car. Drive back home to the child.
Wonderful. Yeah, I was there a long time ago. And it wasn't quite as tense as that. I saw one at night, I think, spotlighting, but it's just a lovely area, full stop. There's, you know, there's all the different wildlife there. There was mouflon and the rabbits, and there are people see polecats there, and there's red deer and wild boar. And
otters.
Otters.
Yeah. And genets are also seen fairly frequently. And there's also a great cave by the dam, which has 3 or 4 different species of bats as well. So it really is a great place to see good European mammals.
And some great food and wine in the area too, so you can't go wrong.
Goes without saying.
And that's what the numbers of lynx, is it tenfold they've increased? It's extraordinary how they've rebounded.
Yes, I don't know the exact numbers, but they've come back very strongly. And what they did was they started up captive breeding programs. They would then do soft releases where they would put out rabbits in a sort of semi-captive area so the lynx could always feed on them. And they've now released them in Portugal. They've been at various different sites across Spain. And I think it's been an amazing success story.
Yeah, wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. And how about you, John? You also have plans of traveling abroad in the next month or so.
I do. I have some ambitious plans. We'll see if they actually happen. The COVID question mark hangs over everything. But yeah, I'm taking my kids to Kenya and Uganda. And Amber will come to Uganda too in July. And yeah, I mean, I set this up as a, you know, this is going to be a family-friendly trip. You know, my son's into everything. My daughter's not. quite so keen sometimes, but she wants to go on safari. But of course, once I started looking into it, the family friendly part of it has taken a little bit of a backseat, because I didn't think there was that much in Kenya really to look for that wasn't a rat that I hadn't seen, but there is. Especially as there's now a place where there's a decent chance to see a crested rat.
Right.
Thanks to Charles. I'm also talking to a researcher about that. Naked mole rats are another animal. For those who don't know them, they're a rodent that live underground, but they're completely naked, so they look bizarre. They've got no fur. But B, they're the only mammal, I think, that they basically live like bees. There's a queen. And she has worker mole rats, I suppose, that bring her food. They're just a really, really weird animal. And I thought, you know, well, there's not much chance of seeing those, but I'm going to Meru National Park in towards the north of Kenya, and I booked into a camp that someone recommended. And, you know, I know there are mole rats in the area. So I just said to the camp, strange question, but do you ever see naked mole rats around? I know they ought to be there. And I was expecting the usual, don't know what they are, never seen them. But no, the lady there gets straight back and goes, oh yes, the camp is overrun with them. So much so that a French film crew were here a few years ago and filmed a documentary on these mole rats, and they caught some and put them in a terrarium. You know, it's supposed to be a chance for 2 days, classic safari with the kids and lions and elephants and those things. But first of all, I need to see the mole rats. So we may well spend a full 2 days in camp sitting by a burrow with a stick waiting. But that, whatever. Yeah.
Well, as it should be. And are you going to try to see the Hirola in either Tsavo or Ishagbini up in northern Kenya? Or is that a step too far?
Yes, I am. They've been reintroduced into, I'm not even sure they're reintroduced. They're in Tsavo East, and that's where people see them. Mm-hmm. So that's on the books. Ishagbini is a place that I tried to get to 10 years ago, and I got to the Tana River, but I couldn't get across the river because the boat wasn't working to get me to the Hirola Sanctuary. And that's the only place, I believe, where Hirolas exist in their original range.
Yeah.
I would love to get there. But it's a little bit dodgy, to say the least. I think there are some security problems up there, mm-hmm. with Al-Habab.
Al-Shabaab.
Turkish restaurant. So there are some problems there. And I'm not, if I was on my own, I think I'd risk it. But with the kids, even, I must be getting very soft in my old age, but I just worry about the kids getting, yeah. So I probably won't go there, although Venkat's planning to.
Right. Okay. Yes, I've heard from the people, some friends in the Nature Conservancy, that the population of Hirola is doing really well, yep. in Ishagbini. So apparently they're pretty easy to see when you do get there. But let's send Venkat out first. And if he makes it back alive, then maybe we can go after him.
Yeah. And if he gets captured, maybe I can go over and negotiate the ransom. So either way, win-win. So we're very, very pleased to have Jose Gabriel Martinez with us today. You might know him as the editor of this podcast. He's a technical wizard behind my Ludditeness on the internet. He's also one of my favorite people in the whole world. He's like a really, really great guy, full stop. He's extremely funny, and he's a complete legend in the field, and we'll be talking about that. You know, I've traveled with him in Nicaragua, in the US, in the Amazon, and I know a number of people on the site have. They'll know him from his reports and his Nicaraguan fame. But Jose, can you introduce yourself to those to those who don't know you and tell us a bit about how you've ended up in Arizona, which is where you're talking from?
I'm primarily a Nicaraguan biologist. I've been working for the last 10 years with amphibian reptiles and small mammals. Mostly in Nicaragua. And since 2011, I have been working with bats and Dr. Carol Chambers, who is a professor here at the Northern Arizona University. So during like almost 8 years, we conducted several research projects related with bats in the Pacific of Nicaragua. And in 2018, I had the opportunity to come here and start a PhD program with her. So that's how I ended in Arizona, in a very short.
I just want to say that I know that, you know, while most of everyone who knows you was delighted that you were coming over to do your PhD. There was also extreme unhappiness that Nicaragua is now off limits to, well, there will be no more Jose Gabriel trips around Nicaragua for a while, but I'm, you know, on balance, I think it's okay. You should do your PhD, but you have to return to Nicaragua before too long.
Yeah, hopefully it's only one more year now. So, and I'm hoping to go back to Nicaragua and do some work there. So there will be opportunities for more mammal watching in the country.
Good. That's what we like to hear.
Absolutely. We're happy to sacrifice your PhD for our mammal watching activities, Jose. Now, Jose, we were talking earlier about some of your PhD work, and you're doing your PhD on bats in Nicaragua. And you were telling us that you have a huge number of sites. You have over 800 different sites. And across these sites, you and some of your research partners have trapped over 26,000 bats, which is a huge number of bats. How exactly you go about trapping bats at a particular site?
Yeah, so the way we decide where we're going to capture bats can vary a lot, depending on what we're looking for and where we're sampling for. But often we are just like looking on the landscape and trying to identify what could be good flyways. And these bat flyways are basically features that bats could use as roads to connect the area where they roost to the areas where they go drink water or forage. So that way our capture effort is a bit more efficient. To actually catch the bats, we usually use what are called mist nets, which are just similar to fishing nets, but they're also used for birds and other animals. And we place them on these flyways. A lot of those flyways can be also riverbeds, in which case we try to place them on top of really slow flowing areas of the river or like little ponds, because we know the bats are coming to drink water from there. So those are usually good places for catching bats, especially in the in dry areas. So like in the desert, or in the case of Nicaragua, like the dry forest.
Great. And these mist nets, basically, they are really fine nets. And the idea being that the bats, when they're echolocating, they won't actually be able to see the net and fly into it, and then you take it out. Is that right?
Yes, Charles. The nets are very fine. And in theory, they are kind of hard to detect by the bat. So they get caught in there, and it has like, they're a bit loose, so the bat can hit the net and fall into these bags. But also, we know some bat species and some bat families are better detecting these nets and avoiding them than others. So if there is a bias on the species that you can catch using mist nets.
Right. And what do you do? Do you actually just wait by the mist net over there, and then as each bat comes in, you go and take it out? Or do you wait until a few bats have been caught? Or how does it work?
Yes, you usually want to be relatively quiet, and you turn your lights off so you don't create like a disturbance and scare the animals away. So you usually place something between 2 to 10 nets, depending on how many people you have. And what we usually do is we check the nets every 10 to 20 minutes. And depending on how busy it is, like how many animals you're capturing, do you want to check the nets more often or leave it for longer? Also, bats have like two, at least in Nicaragua, they have like two big peaks of activity that is kind of like the rush hour. So right after sunset, there's a big peak in activity, and through the night it slows down, and there's a second peak right before sunrise, when a lot of the animals are like coming back to the roost. So during those periods, you want to check the nets more often, but usually by midnight you can check them a bit with more time in between, because the capture rates are usually slower.
Right. And have you ever had any times when the bats just flooded into the nets and you could barely keep up?
Oh, yes. And it's usually like that happens. I think everyone working with bats have a day like that. One of my most memorable days was one time I was working for a survey of a company, and we were rushing to get to this remote place. Was like 4 hours in a bumpy road. And when we got there, we were like, okay, we need to set up nets really quick, because it's we are in the middle of the first peak of activity. And after that, it's pretty slow. So we choose the place by a little river, put four nets, which is not much. And there were three of us. So that was pretty conservative. And we went to check in 10 minutes, and there was nothing. And we were like, let's give it 20 minutes. And when we went the second time, these four nets were like hanging basically close to the ground because of that so many bats were on them. And they were mostly Artibius, fruit eating bats. Those are relatively big. They are very bitey. Mm-hmm. And they make a lot of noise. So they were attracting even more animals. And that night, I think we had about 250 animals, but these are 50, 60 gram bats. So that's a lot of bat hanging from
a lot of biomass.
Yeah. And as you were like taking one out of the net, you just get another one going right next to it, and another one. And we basically had to throw away the four nets. They had so many holes and
destroyed.
They were just destroyed. Yeah.
That's right.
Oh, and so later, after, like, why this happened? When we look, it's like there were three trees of mangoes. Like 50 meters away. So we basically put these nets on the way to
the supermarket.
Like, to the supermarket of the forest. And so that was a good lesson. And now I always look at, okay, where are the next, like the closest fruit trees?
And of course, Jose, that, you know, the science you do is not only a very important science, but it's also extremely important for conservation with all the work you're doing. Now, I think anyone who has traveled, who has been in the field with you, Jose, will have a favorite Jose Gabriel story, probably more than one. I remember being with you in the Amazon where you crawled into a long hollow tree trunk while a couple of us stood at either side with our t-shirts off to block the exits, and you tried to catch a bat and you actually snatched one out of midair with your bare hands and came out with some Micronycteris species, a big-eared bat species that was just incredible. And I've heard you described as being like a cat in the field. And it's true, when you see something you want to catch, like a small animal or even a large animal, knowing you kind of freeze and then you pounce. I've seen you leap over bushes and over fences. Incredible. And you come up holding this animal in your bare hands. You came to fame, though, with your famous capture of a water opossum with Fiona Reid on one of her trips by hand. Could you tell us a little bit about what happened and what goes through your mind? Because I know when I see an animal with big teeth, I'm very reluctant to try and grab it without gloves on or even with gloves on, but you're different.
And before you sort of describe that, if you can actually describe what a water opossum is, because these are the most fantastic beasts.
Okay, yeah. Let's start with the water opossum. I think I knew very little about water opossums until I finally saw one, but it is really a fascinating creature. I always like marsupials from the stories and or from the books. I read when I was a kid and mostly from Australia. But so growing up, I was thrilled to find that there were marsupials in my own country. So yeah, the water opossum is a fascinating animal. They are very, there's sort of, it's an opossum that is very adapted to aquatic or semi-aquatic life in the streams in the neotropics. They have web feet and a watertight pouch where they can carry their young and still being able to dive. They like rocky streams or rocky areas on the streams, and they feel from like crustaceans and other small animals in the water. And they're also very cute looking, in my opinion. They have this nice, almost like a tiger pattern in the back with gray and black.
They're amazing. And I only discovered very recently, you probably know this, that the males also have a pouch that they keep their genitalia in when they swim to stop it from getting tangled up in, well, no one really knows why, but probably to stop it getting tangled in the reeds. So basically the water opossum is the inventor of the Speedo swimming trunks. So there you go.
It's great.
But you're right, they're the most beautiful animal. This is marvelous blacks and grays and whites. They're really distinctive.
Yes, and also the species itself has a big range, but they are they're kind of hard to find and to see. They are mostly nocturnal, and that puts like another layer of difficulty when you're trying to find. But thankfully we have in Nicaragua some place where it has been like relatively reliable to find them. And so I'm very glad about that.
And so when you saw that one with Fiona, what did you actually do to catch it?
Oh yeah, so that was in my very first trip with Fiona. I met her in that trip, and I was invited to the trip by a colleague from Nicaragua who had met Fiona previously in a bat meeting, Arnulfo Medina. And so we were there mostly to help catch bats for the group. And we were, again, after the rush hour of the bats in the night, we were kind of like in the slow part of catching. And I was getting cold because we have been in the water for hours, kind of like to the hip. And of course, it's the geotropics, it's not really cold, but just for being in the water, you get a bit chilly. And I was getting a bit bored. And at some point we heard this little noise on the other side of the river. And this river is, I don't know, like 100 feet wide. And I shined my light and I saw the eye shine and the stripes on the back of the animal. So I was like, oh, this is a water opossum. And I asked the people there, like, should I try to catch it? And yes. they really probably thought I was kidding because it's still pretty far. But anyway, they say yes. So I have my snake tongue in one hand. I am wearing rubber boots and a long sleeve, and I'm mostly like wet. And so I started wading my way to the other side of the river. And at some point the animal start running away along the shore or along the bank of the river. So I start running too, but the water is pretty high. So it's like slow motion running. And the opossum started climbing a tree that was on the bank of the river. So the roots of the tree were maybe, I don't know, 4 meter going into the river, mm-hmm. 4 meter high from the water level. And so, the animal climate there. And I was like, at this point, I was feeling a bit ridiculous by chasing this, but I was like, okay, people are watching me chasing this. I better do my best effort. So I started climbing the tree, and I have my snake tongue on one hand, and the animal had stopped maybe 5 meters from water. And I tried to use my snake tongue to grab it. And I'm just holding my whole weight basically from one hand, and my rubber boots are not very useful.
I'm
holding
full of water. Tree.
Yeah. So I just touched the tail, and he jumped to the water. So when he jumped to the water, I was like, well, he jumped, I'm going to jump too. And so I tried to jump. And again, it's like, I don't know, 4 meters from the above water, and the water is about half a meter deep. But when I jump, my rubber boot got caught on some roots. So I fall to the water like backwards with my head first. And I hit the bottom of the river, which is like super like sandy and kind of like soft. I get up and I still have my snake tongue in the hand. And this whole water and sand coming from my hair. And I just saw the world possum like diving, and as I run through it to it, I saw it like disappear in the water, because it's not like fully clear. Mm-hmm. So I just guessed where it would be, and I used the snake tongue and I got it by the tail. So I lifted up and I was able to like hold it more properly and bring it later to the groups.
Incredible. And
Fiona was really happy about seeing that one. And I remember she say like, John is going to be so jealous. But I didn't know who John was.
And she wrote to me very quickly after that, said, oh my God, you've got to meet this guy, Jose Gabriel. He's just incredible. And you know, the way you tell that, it just sounds like a real life Tom and Jerry cartoon. You've never seen Tom and Jerry Nicaragua, but yes, that's just such a great story.
Yeah, really. And how often have you seen water opossums since then? Do you see them fairly regularly now that you know where and how to look for them, or are they pretty difficult to see?
So they seem pretty they seem like locally common in this place in Bartola in Nicaragua. So I had seen them 7 out of 8 times I've been there, and I have looked for them. And I have seen them in another 2 locations in Nicaragua too, but I don't know how reliable those other 2 sites are. It's very interesting, because one of these other sites is like completely different to Bartola. Bartola is a rainforest, lowland rainforest, super dense. And the other place I found them was a teak plantation in the dry forest. So they seem to be very adaptable to different habitats.
I know that you also once caught a rufous tree rat, which was actually a major range extension for this species in Nicaragua. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, one of the fun things of mammal watching trips in Nicaragua is that we know so little that every time we do a trip, we have a good chance to find something new. And for one of the trips with Fiona, we saw this tree rat, and some of the people in the trip got to take some photos of it. And when we look at the photos, Fiona was very excited, because she said this is probably a rufous tree rat, and the closest record is in central Panama. A good example of how poorly sampled nocturnal animals and small mammals, especially rodents and bats, are in the neotropics, and especially Central America.
in so many places. And it's another, you know, it's another example of how mammal watching as a hobby, those trips can then really help, because if it wasn't for Fiona's trip, I guess it would never have been seen in the first place. So it's this chain reaction, right?
Yes, and to that comment, I need to add that being a biologist in Nicaragua, it's pretty hard. There's not much job opportunities. So being able to conduct some mammal watching trips and was really a huge support for my career, not only by providing some funding and money for a living, but also by meeting people like Fiona Reed and other ones that are so interested in these animals and wildlife in general, that really become an inspiration for being a wildlife biologist.
That's really good to hear. Yeah, no, Fiona deserves a lot of credit for spotting you, the talent scout Fiona Reed, finding Jose Gabriel, and I know she thinks the world of you. So that sort of leads me on to another question I wanted to ask you, Jose, is that you know, when you first went on this trip with Fiona Reed, you were kind of there as a technician to help catch bats. But because of this famous water opossum capture, you know, straight away I was like, I've got to come and meet this man. I want to go out with Jose. And a number of other people then traveled with you. And you quickly became a mammal watching tour guide.
I work as a park ranger in a volcano national park in Nicaragua for a bit. So I kind of had done a bit of guiding before, but for small groups and for a few hours, never a multi-day commitment with the same people. So it was very interesting. The first time I actually had to guide for someone was for John, for you, after Fiona put me in contact to show you the JAPOC. And this friend, I didn't know what to expect. This friend who know you on Facebook told me that you were likely a businessman, millionaire, an eccentric millionaire that likes to see animals. So I didn't know what to expect, and he even like asked me if we could like meet you to offer some business plans for inversion in Nicaragua. So I don't know where he got that from, but it was really interesting. So my expectations were like, I don't know what guiding to this kind of people will be, but before that, a lot of times I will say, I had this joke of saying like, oh yeah, I work with animals, so I can avoid people. But I will say the mama watching community has been really great. And this, I really love how different the people are. Like, they come from different, very different backgrounds. So it's really nice to see that other people have this strong interest, obsession on wildlife, even if their careers are not directly related to biology or wildlife in general.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Yeah, I think it's great that, you know, basically people who are really, really sort of well-versed in rodents and bat biology can make a living, and that there's enough people out there who want to go out and see all of these hard to find and sometimes rare species of small mammals. I think that's fantastic. And it's mostly small mammals that you do though, isn't it? Do you also try to show people some of the primates and some of the bigger things, or they're just not that many in Nicaragua?
Yeah, when I talk about the species that you can target in the country, I really like to focus on the small ones, rodents and bats. Of course, we have few species of monkeys. We only have three, and there are jaguars and tapirs and ocelots, but those are kind of like hard to see. And for someone coming from out of the country, if those are the actual target species, I'm sure there are places that are more reliable for that. So I try to focus on the bats. We have over 100 species of bats, so, and the country is very small, so it's easy to get 2-3 dozens of species in few nights. So I think that's like a big seller for Nicaragua. And same with rodents. I would like to know more about rodents, but again, it's one of those taxa that are really understudied, and I'm sure a lot of this species we find in during the tours could be actually a different species, but they haven't been described, so we're still like assign like a outdated taxonomy name. But
yeah, no, exactly. And one thing, so these people who come to see bats, are there some particular species of bats that people are looking for, or is it the general bat diversity?
I would say there's the general bat diversity. There are a few bats that, for which I know some of the roost that I can like almost guarantee that we're going to see, but I always make clear that I think everybody who do mama watching knows that there's no actual warranty to see anything.
Right.
But it's also so, like Nicaragua is, it's very good for spectral bats. I mean, guaranteed, but it's spectral bat is the largest bat in South America. It's a huge monster of a thing that flies around eating other bats and birds and all sorts of things. And the only ones I've ever seen were two in the same night that Jose caught for me at one particular spot. So, and I know that's a fairly regular bat there, and it's not anywhere else as far as I can tell. It's a very difficult one to see and to catch.
Yeah, it's
fantastic.
We always talk about that species as a jaguar. It's like an apex predator. They feed on other vertebrates, and including bats. So it's really hard to guarantee you're going to see one, but we have been very lucky in several trips to catch at least one. I think we caught two when last time John was in Nicaragua. So that was very, very lucky. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Just to put this in context about sort of Nicaraguan trip is when Jose and I were there, we had eight days together, and we got over 80. Well, I didn't do anything. I just sat there and watched. You got over 80 species of mammals in 8 days, which, it's just extraordinary. It's one of the most prolific trips I've ever had anywhere. For numbers of things. And so it was just like absolutely incredible. And it's partly the country, but it's definitely a lot to do with your ability, Jose, to know where to find stuff and to keep working all through the night, every night.
And
you make your own luck. Yeah. Sorry. Go ahead.
if I remember well, yeah, there were like 86 species and maybe about 45, 50 were bats. So
that's about right. Yeah. It was a hell of a trip.
Yeah, wow. Spectral bats and yapox. That would be quite the trip.
Thank you so much for sharing all those great stories with us. It's always a huge pleasure to talk to you, Jose. And I know you'll be editing this as well, so you'll probably be sick of this interview by the time we've finished cutting it and adding the pictures and everything else. But yeah, lovely to see you and to hear you. And thank you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You've been listening to Mammal Watching with Charles Foley and John Hall. You can find other episodes at mammalwatching.com/podcast.